Well, it's a great honour to have my next guest on the line, my very special guest for this week's show. He was the 29th Prime Minister of Australia. That's just one of many achievements across an extraordinary career in the law, in business, and of course, politics. Malcolm Turnbull, welcome to the King Review.
Oh, thank you very much. Great to be with you.
Now, I always like to ask, particularly, I guess, former politicians, what are you up to these days? What's a typical week like in the life of Malcolm Turnbull?
Well, it's got lots of things in it. I still do quite a bit of speaking and writing and talking like we're doing now. But I think most of my time is really spent back in the venture capital business. You know, my great passion in business has always been in innovative enterprises. And so I'm, you know, very actively involved and invested in a number of Australian tech companies. There's a lot. I'm involved in a lot of companies, so that's basically what I'm doing nowadays. Mm. Yeah, and I'm, working with Andrew Forrest on his big green hydrogen agenda. So I've got no shortage of things to do, and a very active grandfather.
Well, I understand Thursday afternoons in particular are reserved for the grandkids. So that's
yeah.
Very
Thursday
nice to hear.
Thursday is Thursday. Lucy and I show up to Daisy's house early in the morning and take charge.
Grandkids take charge of the grandparents.
Well, they sort of take charge of us, yes. But we have look after them for the day. Yeah.
Very nice. Now, of course, one of your other roles is a co-chair of it's an international body. It's called the Reform for Resilience Commission. I'm not sure a lot of people have heard. You've done a little bit of media on this in recent days, but I'm not sure a lot of people would be too familiar with it. Give us why take on a role like that and what are a little bit of an overview of the Reform for Resilience Commission.
Right. Well, look, there was a number of us who took the view that it was important to make sure that we learnt the lessons of the COVID pandemic. It is an extraordinary event. It's not the first pandemic by any means, but it's the first one that's happened in an environment, in our modern environment, where every country and every community in the world has basically been infected pretty much at the same time, or within weeks of each other. And so it's as though all of the nations and cities and communities have faced an examination, a test at the same time. And, different societies have done better than others, and it's varied. I mean, if you take Australia and the UK, for example, the UK had a catastrophic experience of the pandemic, huge loss of life, massive levels of infection. They clearly didn't lock down soon enough or effectively enough. They didn't restrict international access effectively. It made every mistake. But on the other hand, now they're rolling out the vaccines at a pace that leaves us way behind.
I mean, very different.
So Australia did well on the pandemic, on the quarantine side of it, and then I regret to say we are absolute laggards on the vaccination rollout, which of course leaves us very vulnerable to new variants. Hence the lockdown in Melbourne. But we're focused very much on what are the things we can do to better respond to pandemics in the future to prevent them. So clearly, looking at data transparency. We've got to every country, including China's got to have an open book approach to this in the future, because we all have a vested interest in what's going on in an epidemiological sense anywhere, because viruses don't pay any attention to national borders. The second thing, of course, is we've got to build health resilience. So we've got to ask ourselves the question, there are many other features to this report, and I might say, if anyone listening wants to just Google Reform for Resilience Commission and you'll find it. It's all of the report and so forth is on the web. And I should say this was the sort of convener of this is a British ex-health minister called George Freeman, who's still active member of parliament. And the co-chairs are myself, Michelle Williams, who's the head of public health at Harvard, and José Manuel Barroso, the former Prime Minister of Portugal and President of the European Commission. So, and we've got a powerful, intellectually powerful group of commissioners, all of whom know vastly more about epidemiology than I do, which is to say the least. So anyway, so health resilience is important, you know, and, you know, this, what do we do to address the fact that notwithstanding our increasing affluence in developed countries, technology, health technology and so forth, nonetheless, we're still facing very big problems with, you know, chronic illnesses. And I mean, a lot of that is related to obesity. And, you know, what are we going to do? How do we tackle that? And, of course, that's been obesity has been a big source of vulnerability, you know, as Boris Johnson himself acknowledged. You know, I mean, he came close to dying when he got COVID, and as he, I think, candidly acknowledged himself, it was largely a function of him being very overweight, because he's not an old man by any means.
And it's your view that we are going to experience these types of pandemics with more frequency? I mean, is that part of the reason to do this work?
Well, yes. I think you'd have to assume yes. I mean, no one knows, but the things that spread a virus, which is essentially human travel and interaction, you know, that's pre-COVID was operating at a pace and scale hitherto unknown. So that's not going to stop anytime soon. We wouldn't want it to stop. And of course, the human interaction with animals, which is, you know, whether it is bats or camels or chickens, you know, where a lot of these viruses have come, that is becoming more prevalent, not least because habit, not just because of wet markets like in Wuhan, but because habitats are being destroyed. Humans are encroaching more into the space, the natural habitats of so many different animals. And I think that, you know, that vulnerability is going to continue. So I think you've got to treat this as a wake-up call, not as just saying, oh, well, this is a 1-in-100-year event, because it's not.
The response to COVID, particularly at a federal level, but also, of course, all of the states, it's seen debt levels obviously bring water to your eyes, particularly for a conservative coalition government.
Is that because of tears?
Exactly.
Tears of pain. Yeah.
Tears of pain. I mean, the federal government, the latest forecast is, I think, looking at $1.6 trillion over the next decade of debt, just insane levels of debt. I mean, obviously, that was required to help us get through economically. Your thoughts, though, on budget repair, it hasn't been spoken about. Perhaps it's too early to talk about budget repair. But, I mean, how would you like to see federal and state governments start to tackle or work on reducing some of that debt? Because it is quite extraordinary, and it's our grandchildren and great-grandchildren, of course, who'll pay.
Well, I've given a lot of speeches in Parliament about that, I can tell you. And we were on track federally to, you know, to balance the budget and go back into surplus. And, you know, that was a big part of the work of my government. I mean, Scott was the treasurer.
That's,
and of course,
right. He
continued that after I left. So, look, the answer is this. Unless you want to savagely cut spending, which is difficult to do both at an equitable and a political level.
As former Queensland Premier Campbell Newman discovered when he tried cut too quickly.
Exactly. Exactly. What you've got to do is grow your economy faster than the rate at which your spending is growing. Now, there's a vertical fiscal imbalance in the sense that far too much of the money the states spend is actually just given to them from the Commonwealth, or it comes as the GST, which is a tax the Commonwealth raises. So the states do not raise enough of their own money. But look, this is a really hard nut to crack to change. I think you can assume that vertical fiscal imbalance is going to remain with us for a long time. So let's just look at Australian governments as a whole, you know, and not get into the state v. federal thing. The bottom line is that most government revenues are leveraged on economic growth. You know, the more people that are in work, the more companies that are making profits, the fewer people are on unemployment benefits or, you know, welfare of one kind or another, the more people are paying tax. So if you can grow your economy faster than your expenditure is rising, then you, so will your income receipts, will tax receipts will grow more faster than your expenditure. And that's essentially what we were doing. That was basically the fiscal strategy of the government prior to COVID. But, you know, the laws, the fundamental rules of economics haven't changed. That's what you've got to get back to. And the goal should remain, notwithstanding this hit, to get the budget back into balance over the cycle. So in other words, you know, in normal years, you should be, you know, a small surplus or, a small, you know, more or less at balance. And then that means that you build up, therefore, the firepower to be able to, you know, borrow, which is what just happened, and spend to support aggregate demand in a bad time. Now, I'll just make one other observation about debt. You hear a lot of politicians, more so in the past than now, ranting and raving about the evils of debt. I always used to think that was overdone, because every Australian, whether they've borrowed money to buy their house or they've borrowed money for a business, knows that debt is a very important part of, you know, creating wealth, creating enterprises. So that's true for governments as well, by the way. So the issue is not so much the amount of debt that you have, but the share that it represents, say, by some objective measure like your GDP, and our debt as a percentage of GDP is relatively small, and also what you've borrowed it for. I mean, if you've borrowed it to build productive economic infrastructure, that's very different to just borrowing money because your tax revenues are less than the, you know, the benefits the government is paying, you know, in pensions or whatever. In that case, where you've got a mismatch between government recurrent revenues and government recurrent spending, then you've probably got to increase taxes, you know, unless you want to cut spending. So the good thing about a government budget is once you get back into balance, then you're not adding to debt. And then every year as your economy grows, your existing debt is a smaller and smaller percentage of your GDP. So, you know, that, so you don't have to cut so hard as to, quote, repay debt, you know, but got to repay the debt. That's, I'm not saying that's a bad objective, but it's not really necessary. The goal is to make sure that you're borrowing money, the any increase in borrowing is reflected in new productive assets, and that you're not, you don't have a sort of what they call a structural deficit, which is where, you know, your tax spending ratio is such that you're just always spending more than you're receiving in revenue. A bit like somebody who has a household budget, you know, and their income is, you know, I don't know, family income, say $100,000 a year, and they're spending $150,000. Well, I mean, that's not going to, that can't last forever.
That's not sustainable. You
know, at some point, the mortgage will get tapped out.
You'll get a call from the bank. Are we at risk then of not talking or doing enough about growth? I mean, obviously we're to some extent still in that recovery phase, but, you know, JobKeeper has been out now for a couple of months. It feels like things have stabilized, but I don't hear any talk about what does that future growth look like. Where are the policies to grow? You had the innovation agenda, which was all about growing things. We don't hear that at the moment from the feds.
Every government reflects the personalities of the people that are running it. And, you know, my personality and life's experience was as a business person, an entrepreneur, someone who'd always invested in and promoted innovation. So naturally, those were the values I brought to the role of Prime Minister. Now, I think that was a good thing, and a valuable thing in terms of promoting growth. The current government, that's not there. That's not Scott's background. It's, you know, you don't get that feeling that they don't seem to have a feeling for innovation or entrepreneurship to the same extent. However, they're just as important as ever. So the most important thing is that government is encouraging investment and encouraging entrepreneurship. Now, there is a tendency nowadays for people to say governments should be building this and building that. Governments should invest, but they should be careful that they don't do so in a way that inhibits private investment. Because at the end of the day, the resources in the private sector vastly exceed that in government. I know that may seem a bit, unlikely, but if you look at the global capital markets, they're vastly in excess of the resources of our government at any rate. And so what you really want is the private sector to be doing is to be as energetic and as optimistic and positive as possible. So, this is one of the problems that you would have heard people say with respect to the energy sector, that a lot of
the gas project, of course, in the Hunter, yeah, the Kurri-Kurri.
Yeah, a lot of the government's interventions in the energy sector have actually had the impact of discouraging private investment. And this is what, people in the energy sector have been saying. Now, I mean, government involvement is necessary. It's obviously a regulated industry. And there are some entities that only the government can build. It's very hard. Nobody else could have built Snowy Hydro 2.0 than the government, because Snowy Hydro belonged to the government. So, but equally, if for example the announcement to build a new gas peaker in the Hunter Valley has the result of discouraging other solutions, such as private pumped hydro or private batteries, then that's actually not a good outcome.
Well, that's a nice segue then, talking of energy. One, of course, your other absolute passions for a long time, of course, is action on climate change. It seems like Prime Minister Scott Morrison, there's a little bit of shifting. Of course, he's not there. He's not committing to some of those targets. But, the last couple of days even, there's been a bit more commentary about it. I'm interested to hear from you, Malcolm Turnbull, about the motivation when people are standing at the ballot box when it comes to climate change. Now, we hear a lot about it's a crisis. We need to do something about it. Mm-hmm. But does it... Labor, for example, in the 29 federal election went with a far more ambitious climate change policies than the coalition. And yet, the coalition, particularly in regional Queensland, our audience, has completely outperformed Labor and, of course, won government. So is climate change, despite all of the talk and the warnings and the science, do you think, does it actually translate into votes when people are standing at the ballot, or are there other issues, bigger issues, that impact and influence the way people vote?
Well, the answer is that people are motivated to vote by a whole range of issues. Mm. There are very few people that vote on only one issue. Mm. There are people who might think the coalition is completely wrong on climate, but will nonetheless vote for them because of another issue.
There are other issues that they agree with.
The Labor Party will make taxes too high, so they don't want to pay any more tax. So there's a whole range of things. Mm. So I think that's, people assuming, and it's like, also people stereotyping voters, so they'll say, there's the Catholic vote or the women's vote or the Brisbane vote. Mm. Well, people vote, people vote in different ways and, always have done. So it's a bit more complex. Mm. Look, I think that there are a couple of things going on with climate, and I think this is particularly relevant in Queensland, particularly in central Queensland. Mm. Those politicians who are saying coal is going to go on forever, don't worry about climate change, keep digging it up, keep exporting it, everything's okay, they are actually lying. That's the really scary thing. Mm. Because the thing that will bring the Queensland coal industry to a conclusion is not a speech in the Australian Parliament or the Queensland Parliament. Mm. It is the world moving away from burning coal because they want to cut emissions and because renewables are cheaper. Mm. So there isn't an energy transition going on. And you see it happening in Australia, but it's happening overseas. And it will happen with greater pace. So anyone who thinks we're going to be exporting as much coal in 20 years' time as we are today is absolutely deluded. Mm. And it is really dangerous to be turning what should be a very factual, objective discussion about the physics of global warming and the economic realities of fossil fuels into a sort of issue of culture or identity you know, or religion effectively, you know. So there's a lot of BS going on, and it's very, very misleading. What government should be doing, which is what I sought to do, and, you know, I think with respect, I think Anastasia Palaszczuk is seeking to do this too in Queensland, is that you've got to say, okay, we've got a coal industry, we're not going to undermine that coal industry, excuse the pun, but equally we know that there are huge changes afoot, and we want to make sure that when that we transition into a prosperous clean energy future, right? And so that means, you know, more renewables, it means putting in place the storage, the pumped hydro, you know, batteries, green hydrogen, all of those things, and saying we should be a global leader in the new energy of the future. Instead of treating, as some people on the right of politics do, anything to do with renewables or climate action as being some sort of Bolshevik heresy. You know, the fact is, the cheapest form of new generation today, by a long way, is renewable energy plus storage. So that is where that the world has to transition to there for, to save the planet's health, bluntly. But we also know people are going to move there because it's cheaper. So, you know, let's not turn this into a cultural / religious issue. Let's just approach it in a hard-headed way.
You've warned that the coalition could lose key seats, in fact already have lost key seats to independents because of the climate change issue, the Upper Hunter by-election being a very recent example. I mean, you're not shy about criticising your old party. How do you kind of come to terms with that? I mean, how do you respond to criticism that you are, I guess, very outspoken against your old party, against the Libs and the coalition?
Well, I mean, I've only got one party that I'm a member of, and that's the Liberal Party. So, you know, I'm not a member of the LNP, and I'm certainly not a member of the National Party. So just should be clear about that. I've resigned as Prime Minister. I didn't resign as an Australian citizen. And, you know, it's not my job to, you know, be some kind of echo chamber for whatever the government says. I mean, I've been very helpful. I've been extremely helpful to Scott Morrison, in fact, mostly on a, you know, on a sort of private basis, if you like, and in areas where it's probably not, well, you know, it's up to him what he wants to acknowledge. But the fact of the matter is, I'm entitled to express my views. I mean, I didn't notice anyone in the Liberal Party or associated with the Liberal Party being sparing in their public advice or comments on things I did when I was in politics. I mean,
yes.
You know, every now and then you get sort of various right-wing nut jobs calling for me to be expelled from the Liberal Party. They're the same people who wanted me to be expelled from the Liberal Party when I was the Liberal Prime Minister. I mean, the way in which leading members of the LNP, including the state president at the time, you know, went to extraordinary lengths to undermine my leadership and, you know, basically intimidate and bully people to vote, you know, to vote. You know, this is when Dutton was trying to take his coup. I mean, God. I mean, you know, getting lectures on solidarity and, you know, team spirit from people with that track record is a bit of a joke.
I asked former PM Kevin Rudd this question a couple of months ago when he was on the show, and I expect I'll get the same answer, but no return to politics for Malcolm Turnbull?
Oh, yeah, none for me, no. I mean, but Kevin's younger than me, so he could go around again.
We said Therese would string him up if he ever considered that. So,
it's probably, yes.
Probably
sure
the same.
True. Here's the thing. I mean, I was Prime Minister of Australia, which is a great honour and a great opportunity. I got much more done in the time I was PM than I ever thought I'd be able to, given the nature of the times. And I think my achievements during that time compare very favourably with my predecessor and my successor, right? So I'm, you know, given the time I had. Would I have liked to have been Prime Minister for a few more years? Yeah, but only in order to get more things done. I've never pursued public office or power for its own sake. I've only been interested in what I can do with it. So from my point of view, I got, as I say, I got a lot more done than I thought I would be able to. And I'm, you know, very pleased and gratified to have had the and thankful to have had the opportunity to do it. Mm. So, you know, I'm not, you know, whenever I say something critical of the government or something that government's doing, you get people mostly at News Corp saying, oh, Malcolm Turnbull is bitter and angry. I mean, if I, look, take Christine Holgate. I mean, she was shamefully bullied, humiliated, and the House representatives and sacked most unjustly. And I think 90% of Australians believe that.
Yes. Yep.
If I point that out, am I being bitter? No. I'm just standing up I'm standing up for Christine Holgate. I'm standing up for decent, respectful conduct in high office. Mm. And so all of the positions I've taken are ones that are consistent with the views and principles I've had throughout my public life, and I think are appropriate and defensible and so forth, justified on their merits. Mm. So, you know, I'm not angry or... Here's the thing. When Kevin got rolled, he stayed in Parliament and sought to get his old job back, which he did.
Mm.
When Abbott lost his leadership, he did the same thing. I was absolutely determined not to do that, and so I always said, when I cease to be Prime Minister, I will go. And I did. And so I'm not challenging anyone for any job or anything like that. So.
Finally, Malcolm, I know you absolutely have to run, but I was very keen to hear finally from you about regional Australia.
Yes, please.
There's been a little bit of COVID refugees, COVID evacuees, if you like, from capital cities. You've obviously been a Sydney-sider for a very long time, but the potential for regional Australia, places like Cairns and other beautiful places around the nation, what can regional cities do to boost their populations and attract more people, whether they are entrepreneurs, startup founders, remote workers, people from big corporations who can work from anywhere? What would you like to see happen for regional cities to boost their population and their economies?
Well, look, it's a good point. I mean, you say places like Cairns. I mean, if I may say so, there's nowhere like Cairns. Cairns is, you know, is unique. It's fantastic, just, you know, an amazing place, amazing city. And, you know, I look forward to being back there very soon. I think generally, certainly once the NBN was, you know, essentially complete, and it's, you know, it's a bit like painting the Harbour Bridge, you know. It's a job that'll continue forever, but just about anywhere in Australia now you can get high-speed broadband, and that was the goal, and we got that done. And thank heavens we got it finished before COVID started, I might say, to those people who criticised the approach I took to it. If we'd gone down, you know, the route Kevin had in mind, and I'm not having a go at him, just a factual observation, it would have only been about half built by the time COVID hit. So that's just a little point. But so you've got very widespread, you know, ubiquitous high-speed broadband, and more importantly, everyone has now had the experience of remote working. So, you know, I was just here in Sydney the other day, and I bumped into someone. It would have been about say beginning of the year, late last year maybe. Someone who was a partner in a big law firm, and I said, "What percentage of your workforce are there?" And they said, "Oh, about 10% are coming into the office at any time." And I said, "What's happened to your productivity?" It's improved.
Yeah,
it's
actually, there you go.
You know, it's somewhere between no difference to a bit better. And so the if you'd walked into that law firm 2 years ago and said, "How about everyone work from home?" They would have thought you were bonkers. So the interesting thing is there's been this massive social experiment which has been imposed on us. And you've actually seen that it works. So I reckon you're right. I think the argument for regional centres to be able to say, you can live here and still work anywhere. I mean, look, if I'm sitting in my office, or I'm sitting, we've got Lucy and I've got cattle properties, sheep properties in the Hunter Valley. If I'm sitting up there, I'm sitting on a Zoom or a Teams meeting talking to people in Los Angeles. Am I working at the Hunter Valley or in Sydney or in Los Angeles? I don't know. Your location becomes a sort of almost a theoretical, conceptual issue, because the truth is we're all operating now in a global connected environment. And so, you know, you can, you've got much more flexibility about where you work.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the certainly, you know, I do not think people will go back to in many jobs. Not, you know, if you're driving a train or a ferry, or you know you're working in a cafe, obviously it's very different. But if you're in a typical sort of office job, I don't think people will go back to working 5 days a week, and I don't think employers will want them to either.
Well, I hear the same thing. Productivity has either stayed stable or it's improved. So it's extraordinary to see. Well, we hope to see you, Malcolm Turnbull, perhaps working on the beachfront at Palm Cove or Port Douglas at some point.
Yeah, well, I think Lucy is planning a family holiday in your part of the world later in the year. So
Fantastic.
We're certainly looking forward to it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Wonderful. All right, Malcolm, I really appreciate your time and thanks for being
Great
on the King Review.
No worries. Thanks a lot. Bye.